Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Our study today in 1 Kings. We're beginning the reign of Solomon, and the lesson for today is going to talk about Solomon's wisdom, both wisdom as an administrator and wisdom as a wise man or sage of the Near East. Today's lesson is going to cover basically part of chapter 3 and part of chapter 4. We're going to have to do a little jumping around to get through the book of 1 Kings. So I hope you'll turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 3. We're going to deal with the political marriages that Solomon began to instigate. Now, in chapter 3, verse 1, we find formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh. This was highly unusual. The Egyptians did not give their princesses either to the Babylonians or anybody else. But Egypt was pretty weak during this time, and so was the Mesopotamian empires. That's why Israel was able to develop so fully. It was a political alliance. This became Solomon's practice. We find from chapter 11, verses 4 and 6, that in his later life, these foreign women and their gods turned Solomon's heart away from the Lord, so he wasn't too wise after all. I always thought, you can't be really too wise and have 1,000 wives. You know, that's just a sign something's wrong somewhere. Now, the fact that he married an Egyptian was never condemned in the Scriptures. Now, Canaanite women were condemned as far as intermarriage, but never Egyptian women. Let me give you a few passages. Genesis 24:3 and Deuteronomy 7:3. And Jewish tradition says that she became a proselyte. Even in Solomon's later years, when some of his other foreign wives turned his heart to their gods, there's never an Egyptian influence in Solomon's life. So this lady was a very special lady, apparently. She was the special queen of Solomon. He built her a special house. Matter of fact, her daddy gave Solomon the whole city of Gezer, we learn from chapter 9, verse 16. She had a special house built. She was the queen. She had a dowry. And it was a very special relationship. And then it says, took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David, of course that's Jerusalem, until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Josephus tells us that Solomon extended and increased the fortifications of Jerusalem. For the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles, you might want to see 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 2 through 13. Give us a parallel background. Now, verse 2. The people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Now, the high place here especially is the city of Gibeon. We see it down in verse 4, Gibeon. It is recorded in Joshua 9 how this city was spared through trickery for the people who lived there. It became the place that the tabernacle rested. Now, the ark is going to be in Jerusalem, but the tabernacle stayed in Gibeon a long time, as we learned from last week's lesson about having two priests and Solomon going to Gibeon to offer all the sacrifices when he was anointed king. Now, when it says Solomon loved the Lord, that goes back to Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, about that total dedication he walked in, walking in the statutes of his father David. Now, David did try to keep God's law. But remember, David was a real flagrant violator of God's law. He was a bandit in his early life. He was a mercenary. He was later on an adulterer, a murderer, and on and on. The Bible's not written to super Christians. The Bible's written to people like you and I with problems and passions and temptations. David is called a man after God's own heart. If David, with all his faults, can be a man after God's own heart, you and I can too. And it really helps me to know that David and Solomon had major human flaws and weaknesses, and yet God loved them and used them, and he can use us if we'll let him. Now, then it says, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, it's not later on until the high places are condemned. The high places are not so much a geographical location as a place set aside to local deities or Baals or fertility worship. Solomon was doing this because the house of God was not finished yet, and so Gibeon was a special sanctuary. There were many sanctuaries in Israel from time to time. There was Gilgal, Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Gibeon, but it came to be centralized in Jerusalem and the temple. Deuteronomy says the place where God causes his name to dwell. It was a centralizing of worship, and that was this was an interim period here. Now, you might want to see where it mentions, let's go down to verse 5. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, what will you ask me to give you? Solomon said, thou hast shown great loving kindness to thy servant David, my father. Now, the word loving kindness here is the Hebrew word hesed. It's translated mercy, loving kindness. I think a better translation is steadfast covenant love, or steadfast covenant loyalty, whatever you want to put. It is the special verb that's always used for the people of God. As the special name for God, Yahweh, is always used with the covenant people, so the special verb hesed is always used to describe God's commitment and fidelity to that relationship. Now, when it mentions here about what Solomon would ask for as he began his new reign, the rabbis say God offered him wealth and jewels and all the feet of his enemies, and Solomon rejected it. It doesn't say that here in the Bible. It says that Solomon wanted something else, and here's what it starts. According to, as he walked before thee in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward thee, and thou hast reserved for him this great loving kindness, thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne as it is today. That was a promise back from 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 14. Then verse 7. And now, O Lord my God. Now here's the two most pervasive terms for God in the Old Testament. The first word, Lord, when it's in all caps, is the covenant name for God, Yahweh. You might want to see Exodus 3:14. I am that I am. It's the Hebrew verb to be. The second term, God, is the word Elohim. It's plural, but it's used for God in the sense of his majesty. The rabbis say that Yahweh speaks of God's mercy and Elohim speaks of God's justice. And that may well be true. Now then, thou hast made thy servant king in the place of my father David, yet I am but a little child. Now Josephus tells us that he was 14 years old when he assumed the throne. Most people make him around 20, but he was a very young man. And I do not know how to go out or come in. That is a Deuteronomic phrase, for I don't know what's appropriate. I don't know what's right and wrong in a sense of how I should act, what's appropriate. And he's telling God he doesn't know how to be king. Verse 8, and thy servant in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for their multitude. Now that goes back to the Abrahamic promise that God made that his descendants would be like the sand of the sea and the dust on the ground. Now you might want to see Genesis 13:16 and Genesis 15:5 for this promise of multiplicity of descendants. Verse 9, so give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern both good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine? Now, you might want to see James chapter 1, verse 5, where it talks about we can ask God for wisdom and he won't criticize, he'll give it to us. And God was real pleased with him for asking for a heart that listens and understands. That's what the Hebrew has. Now, then in verse 10, and it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked for this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself a long life, and that means many days, okay, nor have you asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, military victories, but you have asked yourself discernment to understand justice. God's going to give it to him. Now it says that Solomon was a very wise man. If you look at verse 12, you might want to see Jesus makes a comment about this in the gospel, saying one greater than Solomon is here. Matthew 12:42, Luke 11:31. I think this verse right here, it says Solomon is one of the greatest wise men the world's ever known, and yet Solomon fell into great sin in the later days of his life. Much of the books of magic that are even circulated today have their origin traditionally in Solomon. Wisdom is not enough. It needs to be that commitment, personal relationship, and that lifestyle walk. Now, verse 14. If you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. We learn from chapter 11, verses 11 through 14, that Solomon did not live a long, long life. I think probably he died 55 to 60. He turned his heart away. This is the condition here. God said, if you will, I will. Solomon didn't. God didn't. Now, in verse 15 then it says, and Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream, and he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant. See, the Ark's in Jerusalem, but the tabernacle and the brazen altar and the laver, all of that still in Gibeon. And that's why we have these two different scenes. Okay, let's turn over to chapter 4, if we could then, beginning in verse 21. We're still talking about Solomon's wisdom and his power as an administrator and as a wise man. So in 21 down through about 28, we're talking about the area of Solomon's rule and the power of his military machine. It says something of his administrative ability. Now, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river. Now, the river, whenever the word the river in the Bible is mentioned, it's the Euphrates. Now, we're not talking about the mouth of the Euphrates over in Babylon. We're talking about the headwaters of the Euphrates that begin up in northern Syria. So that's the northernmost border of Solomon's reign. The land of the Philistines, that would be the Mediterranean coast, the five cities of Gath and Esculon and all those. Then it says, to the border of Egypt. And that's the river of Egypt. We know it as the Gaza Strip today. Okay? They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. And then in verses 22 and following, we're going to see the elaborate lifestyle that Solomon developed. And Solomon's provisions for one day were 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. Now, a core, according to Josephus, was 86 gallons. According to the rabbis, it was 44 gallons. But whatever it was, that's a huge amount of provisions. And that's not even all. Listen to what else he wants. 10 fattened oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelle, roebucks, and fattened fowl. My goodness, think of all the luxurious lifestyle this man lived. You might want to see chapter 12, verse 4. It really did turn his heart away. The trick is Solomon tried to set up a court like other Eastern monarchs. A large, large harem, large, large banquets. He's going to make forced labor. Solomon really put the dog on, and it's going to split the kingdom later on. In 922, his son's going to split the kingdom because his son tries to continue this very heavy policy of taxation, luxurious living, forced labor. It's not going to work. Now, verse 24. For he had dominion over everything west of the river. That's the headwaters of the Euphrates now. And then we have a term there from Tippesh. Now, this is a word that means ford of the river. It's the only place that the Euphrates can be forded to the north, a special place. Even to Gaza, over all the kings west of the river, and he had peace on all sides round about him. So Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his own vine and his own fig tree. Now, this was a metaphor of success and private security. In a desert country, the difference between the temperature in the sun, the temperature in the shade, can be 60 degrees sometimes. And so to sit under a grapevine or a fig tree was a relaxing time. Be kind of like us going out on the porch in our hammock in our day. Well, that's the idea here. Prosperity, leisure, security. From Dan to Beersheba. Now that became a proverb also from the northernmost part of Israel to the southernmost part of Israel. Now this happened is obviously after the judges period because Dan was allocated a tribal allotment in the very southern part of the promised land. But because of the Amorite pressure, they had to move to the very far north. We find that in Judges 17 and 18. Now, Beersheba is the right on the desert, and I mean by that uninhabited pasture land, way to the south of Jerusalem. Now, look at verse 26. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses. Now, if you have a reference Bible, if you look in the margin, you'll have a note there. There is one Hebrew manuscript that says 4,000. And we learn from 2 Chronicles 9:25, the parallel, that it was 4,000. There's probably been a scribal error here in the Masoretic text of 40,000. 40,000 is too many horses for his chariots, and it's just out of bounds as far as the number. There are some real number problems in these historical books. The difference in Hebrew between the word 4,000 and the word 40,000 is two letters at the end. That's the only difference. The spelling is exactly the same, except those, and one's the little yod. So it's possible that a scribal error occurred here, and I really think 4,000 horses is better. And those deputies provided for King Solomon with all who came to sing Solomon's table, each in his month, they left nothing lacking. We've learned from archaeology that Solomon built these tremendous cities. Megiddo was a city where Solomon stored his horses, some 450 horses, some 200 chariots. And we have found these cities archaeologically all over the Promised Land that verified this historicity here. And verse 29, we're going to turn from Solomon's obvious administrative ability to Solomon's wisdom as far as practical wisdom, poetry, music, those kind of things. Now, God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and a breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Now, Egypt was famous for its wisdom, as the days of Moses help us see. When it says the sons of the East, some think it's a special clan of wise men. Now, there's a whole section of your Old Testament known as wisdom literature. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes. Those are wisdom-type literature, little pithy things, little wise things. And that's the kind of thing that Solomon is going to be noted for. Now, it mentions several wise men here. These must have been famous contemporary wise men. Now, as what Solomon did to his court by making it like other Mesopotamian courts, he did to wisdom literature. For we have found, since in the Rosh Shamrock text, Ugaritic, and many other finds in Egypt, that wisdom literature was a common literary form in the ancient Near East, and Israel just picked up on a common form. Now, artistic endeavors always accompany times of peace and prosperity. So Solomon's reign is the obvious time for the development in Israel of singing and poetry and stories and those kind of things. And that's why so much is attributed to Solomon in the wisdom literature of the Bible. Now, and then it says in verse 32, and he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Now, the fact that it says 1,005, that's not a round number. That's a very specific number. Now, we don't have recorded all these. I personally don't think Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. We only have some of his proverbs recorded in Proverbs. We only have some of his psalms recorded. Most of Solomon's writings have been lost. The vast majority have been lost. Verse 33, and he spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows in the wall. Solomon, it says, is going to use animals and birds and creeping things and fish. He was a man that looked at nature, and from nature and the way nature worked, he brought wisdom to men's life. He used nature as an example. He observed nature to give men wisdom about their life, and that's what it's talking about here. And the men came from all the peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard his wisdom. And obviously here is a reference to the fact that Solomon was wise throughout his days. It's a tragedy that Solomon is in extra-biblical sources as known as the period of time when the genies developed and much magic and sorcery and astrology are related to Solomon's later life when his foreign wives turned his heart away from the Lord. Now, what we have here is a brief account of the beginning of Solomon's reign. Let me talk again through this, because I think it's so important. Remember that the Bible is written for people like you and I. Now, we may not be as rich as David and Solomon, but they had feet of clay. They had major family problems. They had major personality problems. They had major temptations they could not handle. And yet God loved them and used them. I also think it's important to say that here Solomon started off so well. What a great prayer for wisdom to judge God's people. But friends, it's not just where you start that's important. It's where you end up. And Solomon turned away from the Lord later in his life. I'm not saying he wasn't a believer. I'm saying he allowed the priority commitment of his youth to wane in his later days. And we must really watch that. We need to be careful that commitment to God is not an emotional thing at the beginning of our lives, but it is a lifestyle all the way through our days. Christianity, or biblical faith, is not so much periods of commitment or great acts. It's lifestyle commitment. One more thing I think is very important here. God made some tremendous promises to David in 2 Samuel 7:14 about always having a man on the throne. And there's no conditions mentioned in 2 Samuel 7. But when we come to Solomon's life, God begins to put the if in. Solomon, if you will do this, then I will do this. Solomon didn't, and the kingdom was split after his death. Now, I think it's important that we realize that there is a twofold emphasis in the Bible. We are so prone to making things either or that we forget that primarily the Bible is a both and. God's promises are unconditional, 2 Samuel 7. But whenever God makes a promise to man, it is always conditional on man's response. So I usually put it this way. God's promises are secure, and any man or tribe or generation or nation can lock into those promises in faith. But every individual and every nation and every generation must do that afresh and anew in their own lives. There is no ongoing promise that God has made to man that is not conditional on man's response. Now, when I say that, I realize there is a plan of God for history. There is a plan of God for humanity that no one can change. It is set. It is sure. It does not depend on anybody. But even with that overarching plan and will of God, there are individual wills and plans and purposes. It is possible for man to thwart God's will on this lower level. The dignity of man and the awesomeness of God giving us freedom is shown in the fact that we can say no to God. And Solomon, in effect, did that. And that's sometimes hard for us to cope with. I hope you'll turn in the map in the back of your Bible and check these geographical locations I mentioned, the headwaters of the Euphrates and the boundaries and all that. Solomon is going to be the widest that the Jewish people ever have. Now, David conquered most of that land, but Solomon consolidated the reign. Now, he did it through political marriages, which is going to really, really cause him problems. I'd like to give you an assignment for next week, if I could. The lesson next week is going to be very, very difficult. I'd like for you to get a Bible encyclopedia and look up the word temple and read all that you can about Solomon's temple. For next week, we're going to be studying that. It's a very, very difficult lesson, and I hope that you have a Bible dictionary at your disposal. I brought one that I want to show you, if I could. This is a five-volume set. It's called Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia. I'll be using it next week extensively. On lessons like this that deal with Solomon or the temple, to look up the man's name, to look up the book of First Kings, to look up the temple, is very, very helpful for background. Most church libraries have a Bible encyclopedia or a Bible dictionary. Most pastors have one. You can probably borrow it from him. But tell you the truth, this is something you really want to buy for yourself, whether buy it for yourself for a Christmas present or give it to your spouse or something so you'll have it. This is really a helpful volume. People tend to read the Bible as the morning newspaper, which means they don't put enough time in trying to find out what the words and the context meant to the people of its day. You'll never be able to fully understand the Old Testament unless you spend some background time in the cultures and geography and words and phrases of its day. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.